Welcome to the Choose Your Attitude podcast. My name is Nicholas Strand. I am your host. And as always, we are broadcasting on all the audio podcast channels as well as YouTube. You can go find us at podcast.chooseyourattitude.com or the YouTube channel at youtube.chooseyourattitude.com. Please, if you like what you're watching, please make sure you subscribe to us, like us, share us, and as always, please review and share your comments. We love to read them and we love to hear what you guys are saying. I am so excited for today's podcast. Today's episode, we have Kevin Berthia. Kevin Berthia I found on an inspirational video I was watching. It was of a man who was about ready to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. And you would think that that would be a little heavy, which it was. But what's very inspiring about this message is that it shares a lot about the value of listening to others. About listening. Not filling in with help or anything, that the true help is silence. Listening to what people have to say. At the same time, the other thing about understanding and giving somebody true worth is understanding their perspective. That sometimes when someone is challenged with something, that we don't see the full story. We don't see what's triggering them. That their whole life has led them to this. And so it's very important that we learn how to be able to listen, how to be able to understand perspective. And at the same time, what's beautiful about this message too is about learning about acceptance. Acceptance for ourselves. Not ripping ourselves apart when something happens, but embracing it and understanding it and always keeping it on surface so we can better ourselves. What's beautiful about this story is Kevin Berthia is the man who was going to jump over that Golden Gate Bridge. And I'm just super excited to talk to him because he's taken a whole past and has turned it into such a positive, uplifting future. And his message is just extremely strong. So strong that we literally talked for an hour and a half. And so I hope you listen and are just as inspired as I am and many others. I do want to say, because we talk about suicide, if you or somebody you know is experiencing that, to get help, there is help to handle the situation. And that's by contacting the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. That number is 1-800-273-8255. Again, that number is 800-273-8255. Or there is a website, and that's suicidepreventionlifeline.org. They do have chat available, so you can go get help there as well. So that way, if you're unsure about the situation, there's guidance there to be able to help you get that sense. We are going to be talking about that through there. But lead no more. Let's get to everything. But first, we got to start with our sponsorship. This podcast was brought to you by viewers like you and the continuous support of our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by the Choose Your Attitude brand, a premium encouragement brand. Choose Your Attitude is a community that champions the idea that attitude is a choice within everyone's grasp. A brand isn't good without a logo, and boy, does Choose Your Attitude have a meaning. Turn it on its side, it's an hourglass for time, two hearts for community, and the one on the left is your past, while the one on the right is your future, lifting up your past. And of course, the butterfly effect. Although we can't control the trials and tribulations we go through, we can control how we approach them with the power of choice of our attitude. Choose Your Attitude is a premium encouragement brand that offers men's and women's apparel and accessories, lots of selections, continually dropping all kinds of different selections for my podcast listeners. 20% off if you go shop. Here's a discount code. That's podcast20. Use podcast20, get 20% off your order. That is at shop now at chooseyourattitude.com. Again, shop now at chooseyourattitude.com. If you would like to be a sponsor on the Choose Your Attitude podcast, please email us at podcast@chooseyourattitude.com. Again, that's podcast@chooseyourattitude.com. Okay, let's get into this episode. Let's start that intro.
Let's step back a little. Take a look inside our true self. Get comfortable in the uncomfortable. and let's embrace our reality. Life is tough, but so are you. Welcome to the Choose Your Attitude podcast with Nicholas Strand. Join Nick, author of Loving Someone Who's Dying, as he shares his experiences of life loss to life on the road as a traveling roadie. He and his guests will get into real topics while encouraging you to let go of the past, lift up the present, and fiercely build your better tomorrow. Let's get through this together. Now, here's your host, Nick Strand.
All right, welcome to the Choose Your Attitude podcast. Again, my name is Nicholas Strand. I am super excited to have Kevin Berthia on. Kevin, thank you for being on the show today.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for having me, man. Grateful for the opportunity.
You know, I'm super excited to have you on. Your story is very inspiring, heavy at that, but at the same time, very inspiring and motivating. And I was telling friends I was super excited to have you on. It felt weird to have you on, or excited for that, as I'm sure you can understand. We'll go deeper into the conversation, but I want people to hear your side, and I want to hear it through your voice. You know, if you could tell everybody a little bit about yourself and the story, because it's impactful.
Yeah, no problem. My root, like I always try to explain to anybody I come in contact that here's my story. My root, we all have a root that derives where our pain comes from, where our that. And my root is adoption. You know, growing up being having to understand that I was adopted. My mom told me early in life that I was adopted. She never wanted to keep anything from me. But in that, it was hard for me to accept the notion of the idea of somebody looked at me and felt like I wasn't good enough. That was tough, especially growing up being born and raised in Oakland, California. You grow up in a predominantly African-American community, and you know your family and friends, they look alike. They look similar. You know, the mom looks like the son looks like the dad. I mean, everybody looks alike, and just know that, you know, my family was the same color as me, but we didn't look alike. You know, I didn't look like my mom. I didn't look like my dad. I didn't look like my two older sisters. It's something that I struggle with even to this day, just the identity, just the questions of why. And it was a struggle. But in growing up, it was hard for me to stay structured and stay balanced because I did have my family. I had a great loving family. And from the ages of 5 to 13, that life, my life was pretty simple. I mean, I only really struggled at night. During the day, I had a pretty structured schedule. I went to school during the day, woke up, went to school. After school, I had basketball practice. After basketball practice, I had baseball practice. After baseball practice, I had a night basketball practice, and I had games Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and I had church all day Sunday. We went on family trips. We was very family orientated. We sat at the table and ate dinner. You know, we discussed things, and that's just how my life was. So I had that balance. I had my grandfather, who was my mom's father, and you know, he kept me balanced. That was the man that I looked at as the, you know, my connection to my faith and humanity and God and all these different things. So I had the balance. Everything pretty much changed at the age of 13. This is about 1995. I'm entering, going from junior high. I'm going from elementary to junior high. So I always tell people, you have to watch as your kids transition from different schools and different situations. Elementary to junior high is a big shift. We never pay attention to what kids have to go through during that time. I shifted from an elementary, which was in the hills where I lived, where we can run around, play tag. It was, you know, never a sense of violence or anything like that. Structured, teachers really cared, to a junior high where it was the toughest junior high in Oakland, California at the time. Watching kids get beat up and on the first day of school and, you know, stomped out and things that you never even seen or experienced in your life. Now you're having to experience on top of my parents decided to separate and would later on go in divorce in that same year. So my whole life changed. I went from living in the hills in a balanced life to now, you know, being that I was the youngest and the only boy. I wanted to go with my dad and nobody else. You know, my two older sisters wanted to stay with my mom, and having to deal with the pressures of them telling me, you know, if you go stay with dad, you're not going to eat every night. Because my dad was, you know, he wasn't really structured. He didn't really have a structure. He depended on that structure of my mom. And so going to live with my dad and changing environments, this is where everything pretty much changed for me. And this is where I really identifying the things that I struggled with at night by myself. This, now they were presented in my face because it was like a trigger. It was like I didn't have that structure. My dad went from being my first soccer coach to, you know, an absentee parent. I mean, it was just that that's how it really was. He struggled. Everybody struggled with the divorce in their own different ways, but nobody checked on the young, you know, the youngest, which was me, the baby, you know, in a sense, and the one who was the only one that was adopted. When my parents' divorce was the first time I felt like I was adopted. Like every day, it was like I'm adopted. It was just like, yeah, I struggled at night, but no, when my parents divorced, I felt alone in this world. I felt like, you know, and it was a big struggle for me. Age 14 was my first suicide attempt. My uncle left, you know, so just struggled during that time frame. My uncle left a family van in a garage, and, you know, something in my head said, go find the keys one day. I was struggling with a lot of different things. I found the keys and I was taking it. I took that van, but I knew exactly where I wanted to drive. I wanted to drive up, you know, in the hills where I used to live and go drive off the embankment. Cause I remember driving down from when I always used to be with my dad, and I got up there and I drove up, and that was going to be it. I was going to drive over the embankment. I'm a young first time driver. I didn't really see the guardrail that, you know, protects cars from going up. You know, you don't really pay attention to these things. You think you can just drive off like you see it on the movies. And I hit the guardrail and it just snapped me out of whatever I was in, and it kind of shook me up. And I didn't know what to do. You know, I panicked. So I just drove the car back home and I told my mom, you know, I got to, you know, in punishment for joyride. Nobody knew that was a suicide attempt. And I kept that, you know. People didn't find out that was a suicide attempt until I started speaking about, you know, and 3 years after I started speaking, I came out and said that was my first attempt, you know, because I didn't identify it. I wasn't ready to accept that that was my first attempt. You know, 2 years later, I met my biological mom at the age of 16. So my life is just constantly, I'm adding on things without processing things. I'm adding on things, and I'm in a horrible place at this point. You know, once you trigger an attempt, now you're battling so many other different things now, and you're in being that young, I didn't have the capabilities of processing everything. So I thought that bringing my biological mom into my life and meeting her, she was going to be the key to this, fill this void on the inside of me that was been hurt for so many years. Meeting her was just, it just triggered everything even 10 times worse, because it confirmed everything that I told myself. I mean, when I met my mom, she was, you know, she wasn't in a position to be a mom, and I needed her to be a mom because I was hurting from everything else that I was exposed to, you know, because of you. Like, you gave me up to a family. This is where I'm at now. I expected her to come in and fix everything, and that wasn't the case. She was on her own, dealing with her own different things, and psychologically she had a lot going on, and she couldn't process or need to be, she couldn't be anything I needed her to be. And at that time, I hated her for that. I'm old enough now to look back and process certain things and understand certain things, but at the time, I needed her to be a mom, and she couldn't be, and that crushed me even more. About a year later, I met my biological father, and I expected him to come in, since my relationship with my adoptive father has, you know, was you know, completely gone, because my adoptive dad was a compulsive gambler. So our relationship was messed up, because it always had to involve gambling. It had to involve, if I wanted to spend time with him, it had to be on his terms, gambling, horse racing, something that involves gambling. It never was one-on-one doing anything no more. Ever since the divorce, that was over with. So I was expecting my other dad, my biological dad, being I come from him. And when I met my biological dad, this is the first person I actually identified and said, okay, I finally look like somebody. So I expected this relationship to be a certain way. And we immediately clicked, and I felt like a little boy who hasn't seen his dad in so long. And I met him, you know, I'm 16 and a half, you know, I'm 17. I'm almost a man when I meet this man. But it was like, I couldn't shake the kid like feelings of how I felt. He was in my life as quick as he came in, he was out of it. And, on my birthday, September 23rd, 2003, literally, he got arrested for robbing a bank, and, you know, he's been incarcerated ever since. So it's a multitude of things, you know, in that time frame. I go through junior high, get through junior high, go through high school. I'm just all over the place. I never had any goals or aspirations of living, because I never expected to be an adult. So I didn't make plans when I was a kid and had things I wanted to be when I grew up, and, you know, all those different things. Cause I don't know what I thought was going to happen to me, but I was praying every single day to die. So I knew eventually, you know, You know, God would answer my prayer one day. I wouldn't get up. So I never made preparations or plans. So I just got through the motions of got through the days. And, you know, I gained popularity just off of lies, off being an angry person. When in junior high, back in the day when I was going to junior high, it was about talking about people. You know, that's what built your street credibility for some reason. It's just ironic, man. But honestly, it's just how you can talk about something. Who can, if you can do it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If I can talk about you, you know, say 10 things about you before you can say one thing about me, I won that battle. And now everybody thinks that I'm tough. And it was good for me because I was in such a hurtful place that I was always quick to boom, 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 because it kept people off me because I never wanted anybody to really ask me if I really was okay or really just see how vulnerable or really crushed I was on the inside. I mean, because I was all over the place. I was hurting. I was, you know, crying every single night. And I knew that if I ever lost a battle, the people would see the real me. And that's what I was always afraid of. So I knew early in life how to build up this front man that no matter how I was dealing with anything on the inside, nobody ever saw it. They would always see Jovial Kid, the Had It Together part, the life of a party. And that's all people knew me as. So I gained popularity on a person that doesn't even exist. It was a person that I poured into because it was easier being this way because I never wanted to identify with being hurtful, with being sad, with being, you know, any of these things. And it carried on through high school. I got out of high school and it was just like, now what do I do? I can't play all these different sports. You know, I wasn't playing sports, even though I was good enough to probably go to the NBA one day. Not to toot my horn, I was good enough to play Major League Baseball. I played 5 different sports. I mean, I was an athlete, but I knew that being great kept people from looking at you a certain way. So my thing was, I'm not trying to be great to accomplish anything. I'm trying to be great so I can build up this image so nobody ever questions who I am. So it's a completely different, it's completely different for me. You know, you're trying to go to the NFL. I'm just trying to keep myself from, you know, here so that I can figure out how long I got to go. It's just like, you know, tomorrow I may not be here. So I was just waiting on that day. Like, you know, it's just, I knew I wasn't going to be here, man. I'm telling you, like, it's just, so to graduate high school, you know, it was just like, oh man, I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, so I got luckily enough, I got, it was a coach that scouted me, a soccer coach, and he offered me to come to City College of San Francisco. So I went out to City College of San Francisco, you know, and it was just a different spin for me because I'd never been to San Francisco. People that's from Oakland, you know, we kind of stay on in Oakland, you know, we kind of stay tight knit in our community and that's just it, you know. So I only been to the city a couple times. So I just looked at it as an opportunity to see something different. You know, I got out there, got into a couple, you know, classes, got on my own. And I kind of saw myself thriving by myself. I still hadn't handled any issue in my life. I hadn't processed any of these things. I never looked at it as I had a mental health condition, depression. I never knew any of those things. Never heard those things. Never. So none of those things were in question. I just was, you know, dealing with a couple things and I was just moving on. So I got out to City College San Francisco, got on the soccer team. You know, and at that time, that soccer team was ranked in the nation. Like, we were top 10 in the nation in 2000. So, you know, this is, you know, I'm at an elite level, and I'm not even putting it into it. It's just, I need to be here because it keeps me mentally, you know, above water. And that's all it was about. So, the worst thing I could have did in that situation, when I got out to city, is I started thriving, everything was good. I met a girl. And, you know, from that, I formed a relationship. And the worst thing, that's why I say young people, you got to get your life together before you get in a relationship with somebody else who doesn't have their life together. Because that is like, it's catastrophe. That's the Titanic in everybody's life and we don't see it. Like, I was never in a situation. Look at all the things I have going on. Did I sound like I was prepared to be in a relationship? I mean, absolutely not. But here I am young. That's what you do. You know, you get in a relationship. And we just fought. We clashed. So many different things happened, trying to merge two different individuals from two different backgrounds. And it's just in these arguments, things start triggering in me. And it's just, I could see myself getting worse and worse and worse. And I'm not even identifying this. And then I remember, you know, we was together about a year and a half. And it was just arguing, you know, it was just, I don't even know what we are back then. Looking back. No mortgage, no kids. Like, what do we have? What was the problem? But it's just, that's just what it is. When you have two people that just have two, she had her own issues. I have my own issues, and we reach each other's triggers. And it just, on one particular day, I remember being at my mom's house and, you know, we had just got, you know, I had convinced my mom to have her come over, you know, because my mom at the time was like, you know, you're not married, you're not bringing any women over, all these different things. I was staying with my mom. I was going to different things. And she had came over and we got into this big argument. At the time, it's just my older sister at the house. And something clicked that day. And I couldn't control myself. It was just like I was so overwhelmed from dealing with my biological mom, dealing with my biological dad, dealing with my adoptive dad, dealing with my mom, dealing with all these different emotions, dealing with her, dealing with trying to figure out my own life, dealing with my own feelings of how I feel about being adopted. It was just so many things. And it just, on that particular day, on the way out, I just was storming out the house. And as I'm walking out, the biggest knife in the house just happened to be on the table. I don't know. I picked it up and I ran out, and my sister never seen me like this because she only knows me as a jovial. She seen me cry a couple times, but never to this magnitude. She didn't know what to do. So she called the Oakland Police Department. They come out. They find me on my stairs, you know, which is on the side, lead on the side of my house. And I got this knife to my neck. And for some reason, for me, I'm in control, man. And I don't, it may not be a control what people understand, but for the first time in my life, I dictate what's going to happen in the next couple of seconds. And I needed that. I've never been in control of situations. Everything in my life has been taken from me. Everything in my life, that no matter how much I loved it, has been taken from me, has been able to been saying no this way. And I control what was going on. And it was like a powerful moment. It's like I felt like the most powerful man on the planet as I held that knife to my neck. And I couldn't let it go. And, you know, you go on for about 15, 20 minutes, you know, with the local authorities. And, you know, they got tired of me not taking his knife down. So they tased me. So, and I always tell people, no lie, you never want to be tased in your life. That is the worst feeling, you know. I still have the mark on my chest. And I dropped that knife. And the next thing I came to, like when I really came to in my brain, I was, you know, had one arm handcuffed, you know, to a hospital bed, and I'm trying to figure out where I was at. I was literally at, you know, a psychiatric hospital. I didn't even know these places existed. All I keep hearing is all this loud noise, people yelling. And, you know, for me, 2 days ago, I just left a party where one of my friend's birthday, he put my face on his flyer just so everybody would come. Like, that, you know, so for 2 days ago, I was just a life of the party. How am I in this situation where I'm at now? It doesn't make any sense. And I'm like, it won't click in my brain because I didn't, you know, I never knew these places existed. Like, I don't know where I'm at. I just know I'm not in jail. I know it's people yelling. And it's just, you know, in my brain, I'm thinking, these people is crazy. Not knowing where I'm at, not knowing what I'm dealing with, not knowing that the things that I'm identifying that these people are struggling with, Kevin, you're struggling with the same things. You just have your different coping mechanism how you're dealing with, but you're at the same place for a reason. But I didn't identify that at 19 when I was there, because in that time frame, I never heard any of these things that when these doctors were coming in and nurses were telling me, and they telling me about 5150, the number, you know, and we got a hold on you and you can't go anywhere, and depression and suicide attempt. I'm 19 years old. I've never heard these words in my life. I've been to every assembly. I, just growing up in junior high school, they never talked about suicide attempt. They never talked about mental health. So at 19 is the first time you want to tell me that I have something that, now I believe I'm the only person in the world has it, because I've never heard of it. I already feel alone because I'm adopted. I already feel I'm going through so many different things. So, you know, I'm just like, well, whatever I need to do to get out of this hospital, that's what I'm going to do. And that's what I did, you know, just to get out. I went home. I denied everything happened. My mom was struggling. My adoptive mom was struggling, you know, because I, you know, because of the whole knife incident. I told her, Mom, I just had a bad day. Like, nobody, everybody relaxed, but she couldn't deal with it. I went to end up going to outpatient at Kaiser for her. In that outpatient, they put me in a group therapy. I don't know how they thought I was comfortable. They never asked me, have you ever talked about your problems before? They thought I was going to be comfortable never talking about my problems and then slamming me into a group therapy where everybody's talking about their problems, not knowing that I'm probably one of the most empathetic people on the planet. And all these people's problems are triggering all these different things in me. I'm hearing all these different things, these hurtful stories, and it's just I can't handle it, man. And then they put me in these one-on-one sessions with a therapist who never really connected with me, told me that I should be over being adopted. How can I be over something, sir, that I've never dealt with? You know, so I went away from that. Over the next time frame, I go through six different therapists who prescribed me six different medications. And I'm done with therapy. I went from having the one suicide attempt at 14, the second suicide attempt at, you know, they say that's an attempt at 19. Just in a 11-month time frame, I'm up to, you know, I do a seven different attempts in that 7-month time frame. In that 11-month time frame, because, you know, I'm overwhelmed. I'm dealing with so many different things. I can't figure it out. And I just want to die. I don't want to be here. Like, I'm trying to figure it out. I looked up, you know, thing how to cut myself. I'm looking up how much alcohol I need to drink to you know, get alcohol poisoning, you know, food poisoning, anything that I, you know, pills, all these different things that I'm doing, you know. I fell asleep at the wheel, got into a massive car accident. And I was trying to die, so I crashed into the cars, totaled out six different cars, you know, like, and nobody knew that was an attempt. I walked away from that event, from that crash, and nobody knew that was an attempt. They thought that I fell asleep at the wheel because I said I fell asleep, because I didn't want to deal with that. But I was trying to die. I took my seatbelt off and literally, like, smacked into, you know, at 65 miles an hour, smacked into some parked cars because I was trying to die and live from that and walked away from the scene and never went to the hospital for that. Like, that's the type of miracle the type of things that have happened to me that is even before the bridge. This is before the bridge. People look at the bridge and they don't realize my life, like, it took a lot. That's what led me to the bridge. It's not like I didn't get up one day and just, oh, I'm gonna drive myself to the Golden Gate Bridge. No, I was tired. You know, you add, you know, my, you know, after dealing with another failed relationship, I get into another relationship and we end up having a baby after all this. And I'm never prepared for fatherhood, man. Nobody tells you, you know, you need to prepare for the emotions that come with being a father. Then she was premature. Another weight of emotion because I blame myself for everything. Like, that's just who I am, being adopted. When things go wrong in my life, it's my fault. Like, I'm the reason. I'm the reason my parents got divorced. I'm the reason this happened. I'm the reason that this relationship didn't work. I'm the reason this, it's me. It all falls on me. So when this baby comes early, I'm the reason she came early. Like, you know, I'm the reason she's struggling in a glass incubator with all these tubes on her, like, you know, fighting for her life and having to go through these hernia surgeries. I'm that reason. And that was one of the hardest struggles for me. Even to this day, that is something I'm still trying to find a way to heal from. And she's 17 years old. It's those type of things, because I haven't processed, because I haven't dealt with them, because I'm learning to deal with them. These are the things that led me to the Golden Gate Bridge. Not just getting up one day and thinking that it would be cool to get the attention. It was me trying to find a foolproof plan that was going to work on March 11, 2005, because I was done, you know, after losing my job, after finding out I might have to pay $250,000 hospital bill for my daughter being in the hospital being premature. You know, I didn't know that insurance covers this. I'm young, man. I called around. They told me I had to pay this much. I had to please pay 66% of it, or I'm still doing the numbers. Like, I can't come up. There's no way. Like, I just lost my job. Like, you know, it was so many different things going on with me. And on March 11, 2005, when I woke up, I was like, all right, this is it. I got to come up with a foolproof plan. I didn't even know where the Golden Gate Bridge was. I didn't even know it was iconic for suicide attempts. That day, I thought I was the first person that was gonna, for some reason, I thought I was gonna be the first person that was going to this bridge and jumping off of it. That's the truth. Like, and that's why my story, I can't understand it some days for myself, because most people already have an epiphany about the bridge. They Googled it, they wrote it down, and they had a dream about it. They talk about it. I've talked to the thousands of people that have either encountered somebody that's went, or went themselves, and nobody just says it just on the day they thought about the bridge. No, I didn't even know this place existed. So we didn't have on my phone where I can look it up. You know, I had to old fashioned ask for directions to this place. Did I know, you know, that it was a place that thousands of people before me have went? No, absolutely not. I knew nothing about it. Why did I pick the Golden Gate Bridge? I had no idea. I don't know. I still don't know. You know, I still have no idea. You know, you have to take that up with the man upstairs. That has nothing to do with me. You know, and that's where I picked that day. That's where I was on my way to. When I was at banking on, when I asked for directions, you know, they would look at me and feel like I would already should know where the Golden Gate Bridge was and ask me why I was going. Because I was already ready to talk. So much of me was already ready to talk about why I wanted to go. I was just flooded with just, I was ready. I was ready in that moment to just talk. But when I asked the toll taker, she didn't even give me an opportunity. She didn't even look at me. She just gave me directions, put me on my way. And I just knew I got on my way. So then I got out there and I got lost trying to find, you know, the bridge. All I'm trying to do, now I feel like I'm completely failure because all I'm trying to do is get to the bridge and jump off of it. And I can't even find it. So it's just, you know, it's just ironic. It's just, man, I'm going through all these different things and it's just finally I find it. Takes me an hour to find it. I get out there and it's just magically a park right in front. And if anybody knows Golden Gate Bridge, it's never a park where I parked right in front on the North Tower. But magically that day it was a park right there. It was a park. Like it was destined for me. And I got out, you know, the car, left the keys in the ignition. I grabbed my prepaid phone and I got out there. And now I really wasn't so much looking for a reason to talk. I didn't want to talk anymore. When I got out there on the bridge, it was done. I didn't want to talk. I was more so looking for a reason not to jump. And I walked for about 15 minutes and I couldn't find a reason to make one phone call, which didn't really, you know, go the way I wanted to go. And I looked over the railing. I remember looking over the railing. And when I looked over the railing, I saw the water. I saw nothing that was going to deter me. I saw nothing that was going to stop me. But when I looked over that water for the first time in my life, I saw peace. Like, you know, I saw my peace. I saw Kevin, you don't have to wake up being a lie anymore. Like you can just, you don't have to wake up wanting to die. You don't have to be a burden. You know, you don't have to be all these different things. You don't have to wake up hating yourself. You don't have to wake up battling yourself. Like you don't have to wake up feeling like a failure. You don't have to wake up feeling like, why does she give you what? Like all these different things. I looked in that water and I saw my peace. And I stood a couple steps back, put my phone down, and I started going towards the railing. And I remember jumping over, getting, I remember literally being in the air. And that's when I heard a voice. And it wasn't like a voice of, hey, what are you doing? Because I wouldn't have stopped for a, hey, what are you doing type of voice. Yep. It was a more of a, hey, what's going on? Like they care. And it was enough to distract me. I'm, you know, honest, you know, it was enough to distract me. And I'm an athletic guy. You know, I've been dunking a basketball since I was in the ninth grade. Like, you know, that's just who I am. Like, you know, and I stand only 5'8", 5'9". That's just who I am. Like, I've always been athletic. I literally jumped over the railing. I'm airborne in the railing and I jumped and I grabbed the railing on my left arm because my left arm is, you know, long. Like I have a 6'5" man's reach with my left arm. That's just how it is. And I grabbed the railing and I turned myself around on this core. But now I'm frustrated and angry because I didn't come here to be, you know, first of all, I'm afraid of heights and I hate being cold. This is San Francisco in March. I'm 220 feet in the air and it's 40 something degrees. So now I put myself in the worst possible position I can ever possibly put myself in life. And this voice is still trying to get my attention and I'm yelling at him. Like literally yelling at him. I'm not holding on. You know, I'm telling him, stay back. You come a little closer, I'm nudging back and I'm out. Like that. These is literally what I'm telling him. Stay back or else. Like I'm yelling at him because I am infuriated at myself because I was supposed to be in that water. I wasn't supposed to be on this ledge. So now we go back and forth for about 15 minutes, literally. And I'm yelling, you know. And finally, something on the inside of me just said, why do you care? Just like that. Like, because it's just like he wasn't going away. It wasn't like he was like making me feel like I was stupid. Like I was already making myself feel like I knew where I know the situation I was in. Like I knew I was standing on a ledge. I knew I had traffic at a standstill. I knew I had a helicopter. I knew I felt all these things. I felt how stupid I looked. And he never made me feel like that. It was just like, you know, his voice was just, it was so penetrating. It was so calm. It was just like, all right, man, well, why do you care? Like, and it was just enough. And he got closer and I just started talking, man. Like, I just started talking. And I started at the age of 5 and I worked myself all the way up to the age of where I was at, 22. He learned about 17 years and he never interrupted me. And literally, I don't know how I stayed on that ledge. I don't know how I stayed in that position that I was in. But somehow, some kind of way, for 96 minutes, I stayed in that position. Like, man, like, I've been back to the bridge, man, since that day. And I don't know how this is even mathematically possible, even for myself. Like, you know, but he just literally listened. I talked about everything. Everything I wanted to tell my adoptive dad, everything I wanted to tell my adoptive dad, mom, my biological mom, my biological dad, everything I wanted to tell every single coach, teacher, family member, cousin, preacher, teacher, everybody that was ever connected to me that I ever just wanted to just tell how I really felt. I just spilled my whole heart to a stranger. I kept my head down the whole time. I never knew he was a cop. I never knew he was white. I never knew anything about him because my head stayed down because I was petrified. I was so afraid of the situation I was in. So I just kept my eyes closed and I just spilled my heart. I never knew anything about this man. Never. Never. This conversation, if I knew he was white and a cop, the conversation would have been different. I'm a black man from Oakland, California. My idea of law enforcement at the time is horrible because of my encounters that I faced. So because I kept my eyes closed, I never knew exactly who I was speaking to. For all my old notion, he was a stranger that happened to walk by and cared enough. I never knew he was a first responder. Never in my mildest imaginations. But after I got everything out, I realized, you know, he made me realize that I needed to be there for my daughter. It was a different emotion when I talked about her. And she made me realize that her birthday was coming up. Her first birthday was April 6th. I went to the bridge March 11th. It's like, Kevin, you got to be here for her first birthday. And just hearing that, because he listened, he was able to identify, like, just hearing that part, just like, man, her first birthday is just like, you know, after getting all that stuff out, all those weights out from all that things that I wanted to say, I was able to just, you know, put my hands up and I couldn't even lift myself up. And I just remember, you know, I remember them lifting me up and I remember them, you know, putting my t-shirt over my face because, you know, it was people taking pictures and things like that. And then the next thing I knew, I was at San Francisco General. And the next thing after that, I was taken to, you know, a medical center, you know, in Fremont. And I stayed there for about 16 days. And I had to just get back in the vein of eating and sleeping again because, you know, months before that, I stopped eating and sleeping. I was preparing to die. Like, I prepared my body to die. I stopped eating. I stopped sleeping. I stopped doing everything that was important to me. I stopped being around my family. I stopped being around my daughter. Like, you know, and I was, you know, that's just where I was at. So I had to get back into the framework. I literally got out of that hospital, got home. My mom showed me that a picture of me, that photo was front page in the San Francisco Chronicle, March 12th, Saturday newspaper. Now, I've played sports my whole life. We all want to be front page one day. Not like this. Yeah. Like, not like this, man. Like, this was, it was, I didn't believe it. Because now, even though that picture was from the back and the picture on the inside and the article covered up my face, anybody that knew me knew that was me. And I couldn't, my cover was blown. I didn't know who I was going to go back to because I spent seconds, years, minutes, I spent my whole life pouring into an individual, making everybody make it look like he had it all together. And all I kept saying is to myself is, who goes to the bridge? Who jumps off the bridge, Kevin? I never could get over that and I never could accept it. So I didn't. I didn't go to therapy after I went to the bridge. You would think somebody needs to go to outpatient. They need to be on medication. I didn't. I lied about it for 8 years. In that 8 years, I had probably another 10 attempts. You know, my grandfather died. My closest link of God, of what I, the idea of humanity, the idea of everything died in 2007, 2 years after I went to the bridge. Like, that was the turning point of all everything for me because I didn't have anybody left in my life anymore. You know? Tough, man. It's tough. And I just, you know, I tried my hardest to just work things out. I've been trying on my own for so long, and that's the problem. I've been trying to do it on my own. 2013 came around. I went through my own divorce in 2011. That crushed me. You know, going through a divorce is, you know, that's probably the hardest thing people have to understand you have to go through. To be adopted, to watch your parents divorce, and then to go through your own divorce. Like, people don't get, like, my life has been the bridge. Like, you know, and I've tried to always just rise above and rise above, but I've never, until I accepted who I was, I never was going to rise above it. 2013 came around, and I was up to 22 failed suicide attempts, man. My New Year's resolution for 2013, I knew I wasn't going to be alive no more. I was in a bad relationship. I was in, you know, with the mother of my kids, you know, lying about who I was still to the world. Lying to that I'm struggling and I've been in this dark place for so many years that I can't even, I don't know what light is at this point. And that's why I understand the dark place so well, because I lived there for so long. And 2013 came around, and I just is like, let me just stay alive for my mom's birthday. My mom's birthday is February 15th. And I just said, let me be alive. Let me just be around for her birthday. And I took her, you know, went out and I took her. She didn't even know I was saying goodbye, man. You know, that's when she got a letter from the America's Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And in that letter, she wrote a letter to Officer Briggs eight years ago in 2005, thanking him for saving my life. And he held on to that letter. And they have a Lifesavers, dinner every year in New York, you know, fancy little dinner or whatever. And, you know, people come together and they honor somebody for being a lifesaver. Well, in 2013, Briggs was up, and he, you know, I guess they were looking for somebody to interview or, you know, present his award. And, you know, it's hard to find somebody he saved or, you know, so they was looking for a pinger. He thought about my mom because he had that letter. Yeah. Hard to imagine he held on to that letter for that many years, but he did. And I don't know who this man is. I've only dealt with this picture twice. My mom showed me when I got out the hospital, and then my ex used it against me in court in a custody battle. And that's the only time I ever dealt with that picture. So I still didn't know that this man was a cop. I knew nothing about him. Still didn't know anything, and still didn't accept that it was me that went to the bridge. So, you know, they reached out to my mom. My mom, you know, she can't fly. She's had a stroke. They've been dealing with different things. So she kind of convinced me. Everybody that knows me knows I don't ask any questions. When somebody wants me to do something, I just do it. That's just me. Like, that's been me my whole life. You asked me to do this podcast. I didn't ask any questions. Let's just do it. Like, you know, that's just me. So she just was like, you know, she kind of convinced me to go to New York. She didn't really say what it's about. She just kind of, I mean, you know, and I was in a situation, I didn't really, you know, why I'm going to turn down New York? I've never been there before. You know, she made it out to be like a radio station thing or whatever. I don't know. She just told me whatever. It didn't take much. It was New York, a free trip. Like, okay, I get on a flight. You know, I get out there and, you know, and I'm with the mother of my kids at the time, you know. Go figure, you know, one of my biggest triggers, you know, and she's there with me. And, you know, it was for the first time, you know, I remember it was a message waiting for me. And I remember it was from the radio station. And I'm thinking, hey, I got to tell them, like, OK, I'm not my mom. This is what happened. She had me come. But they say, they get on the phone. And they're so excited to talk to me. I've never had anybody this excited to talk to me in my life. And I don't even know why. They're like, hey, man, we're so excited to talk to you. And they have all this energy, and it was like, we want to talk about your 8-year reunion with your first responder. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? And I was like, you know, let me call you right back. Let me change a couple things. Let me call you right back. I call my mom. She said, yeah, you're there. I call my mom. She said, yeah, you're there. You're going to meet the man in the photo, your first responder. I'm like, mom. Like, a little more information would have been collected in New York now. What can I do? Yeah. So I got to call the radio station back that called in back. And they literally asked me about everything that happened. Like, we're talking like now. They asked me about what led up to March 11, 2005. They had no idea that this is the first time that I'm talking about it in my life. Like, it's the first time. Yeah. And it's like no dead airplay. Like, or dead airtime. Whatever they said, they were so excited. They were like, man, you didn't have no dead air time. It was just, you just flowed. And it was just like, I didn't know that was preparing me because I knew I knew that I was there. Now I knew I kind of got anxiety because I knew I was meeting the guy, you know? And it was like, you know, it was like, I knew he kind of saved my life. So I didn't know what kind of guy he was, if he was going to be wanting me to, you know, like, you know, I don't know, bow at him. I don't know, man. I just don't know how people are, man. You know, just, you just never know. But I met him at the Columbus Circle, and I remember getting over there. And I remember as soon as I met him, As soon as I got around him and I shook his hand, I knew exactly who. I knew how and why he saved me. I knew it had to be him. He's probably the only person in the world that could have did what he did. And it's just him. We have a connection. And that's just what it is. It was just like two high school buddies that haven't seen each other in a long time. This is the first time I'm meeting this man for the first time in 8 years. He saw me at my worst moment. That was how we met. Now he's seeing me, you know, and I'm like, he has no idea that psychologically I'm still contemplating dying. Like, up until this point. And here I am shaking his hand, and it just completely, it took me back to that day. Like, wow, you really helped me that day. And it really made me think about certain things. I had no idea what was to come next. So we get into to the venue, and it's this nice venue. It's all decked out. Everybody got all these nice suits and ties. And it's, you know, it's important people in here. Doctors, lawyers, a lot of important individuals in here. And you know, Briggs gets on stage, and a Yahoo documentary gets up. And it's this big old jumbo screen. And I remember I'm looking at the crowd. I'm faced this way. And the crowd goes, like that. They gasp. So, of course, I'm like, I don't know what they're looking at. So I turned around and look at it. It's me. It's the photo of me on the bridge. Third time I see it, right? Third time a charm. As immediately as I looked at it, I accepted that it was me in the photo. On the inside. On the inside, I said, that's me. I got up on that stage and I talked openly for the first time about everything in front of a crowd, you know, 300, 400 people, man. I've never talked about anything serious in my life in front of people. And here I am talking about my story in front of this crowd. And I remember when I came down, I felt different. And I remember it was kind of a line starting to form. And it was a lady in line. She was in the line at my table. And I remember she stood there and I could tell she was crying. And that just, it had me kind of, you know, crying on the inside. Oh man, come on, lady. This is the first time. This is the first mother. I didn't even know that this was about to happen. She's the first mother. This is the first time I opened up in my life and was vulnerable. This is the first mother. I've talked to probably 1,000 mothers who lost a son. But this is the first one. Had no idea. She said, look at me. Because I couldn't look at her because she was just, I knew I was just sad. Like, it was just so much for me. But she said, look at me. She said, my son Jacob lost his battle 5 years ago. She said, I haven't slept in 5 years. But tonight I'm going to sleep because now I can better understand what Jacob was going through. Thank you for telling your story. You just helped me. And when she said that, two things happened. For the first time in my life, I didn't feel alone. But two, I knew that it was so much bigger than me. It was. And I knew I had to make a change. That was New York Kevin. I always said that was New York Kevin. New York Kevin was the Kevin I always wanted to be. He was compassionate. He was caring. He was vulnerable. He didn't mind crying. He didn't mind showing emotion because he knew that's what tapped him into humanity. He wasn't trying to be tough. He wasn't trying to be something that he wasn't trying to be. And these people love me for that person. And I got back to California and I had to make a decision. I said, okay, Kevin, who do you want to be? Because these people respected you for being who you always wanted to be, who your grandfather would have been proud of. Now you got to make a decision. And I made a decision. It took me a while, but I knew I had to make some changes. I was still in that relationship. I was still around friends that I shouldn't have been around. I still was in an environment. I still was around so many different things. And that's why I tell people, if you want to change things in your life, you gotta really, really make some sacrifices. And on May 21st, 2013, which is coming up, that my anniversary of that day is coming up. May 21st, 2013 was the first day I woke up and I didn't want to die. And I told myself, whatever I did, I'm never going to stop this feeling. I woke up and I heard the song Grateful and something changed about me. And I wanted to show the world who I really was. I wanted to give back to humanity. Like, I wanted the people to know that I care about you. I don't care what you look like. I don't care what you're going through. I don't care what you've done. I care about you. Like, man, I care about you so much.
there's somebody out there that's struggling, man. And I need them to know that I care, man. And that's just all my message is being. I've been able to travel around this country, man, and be blessed, man. I've been to about, 36 different states, man. I've been out the country. I've been to South Korea. I've been to Alaska. And it's just telling my story, man. I don't get on that stage and show people statistics and I just tell them my story and I because I know that when I get off that stage, I'm there for somebody who needs to talk to me. And I travel around and I'm on Facebook groups and I just travel and I try to do as much as I can for humanity. I lied so many years for who I am, and I just think about how many people I lost in that time frame. And I just gotta give back. I gotta give everything I can, and that's just where I'm at now. Sorry, man. That's my story, man. I apologize. I went
Do
over
not
anything.
Apologize. That is, it's beautiful. First one where you actually got me tearing up on the podcast.
Sorry about that, man.
No,
I'm
don't
sorry.
Be sorry. It's real. And, you make a huge point that I've seen as well. And that's being real to your emotion. That's being real to your heart. That's, sharing that, some of the notes I wrote down was, the idea that, especially with men, we're challenged to, hide that pain. And it's tough. The story was great.
It's different, man. It's different now because I don't get the opportunity like I want to share it because of the pandemic. So yep. The emotion, I mean, it's different when I was boom, 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 boom. I'm able to like, okay. But now it's just like, oh man. And I see where people are at, and it makes my heart a certain way now, because I know that there's so many people out there whose lives have changed, including mine. Like I don't get the opportunity to go speak and be to the masses. I just was coming up on, being able to talk to 5,000 people at a time and things like that. Like, where I can really make an imprint and just feel like I'm making an imprint. Now it's just like the one or two or the three or the four or the five. Those you I don't take it for granted, but it's like you want to be making a bigger impact when you have it in you. You have the tools. I've never met a person that was in a dark place that I haven't been able to show them their light. Not a light. I haven't been able to show them their light. See, it's a difference. We all have the light. Like you can't, like, it's embedded in us. It doesn't change. It doesn't stop. It doesn't, and to be honest, we die with it. No matter how we die with that light. Like, and that light is to light the world. Like, we are the light of the world. Like, it's in us. And I challenge anybody, like, that's why I don't want to be big for Kevin Berthia. I want to be big for Kevin Berthia's message. Like, I don't want a million followers because I want people to think I'm so cool. I want a million followers because I want a million people to know that they're valuable. I want a million people that don't think they're valuable, a million people that are in a dark place to know how valuable they are. And that dark place is preparing them for the light that they're about to face. Like, that's just who I am. But, you give me the opportunity and, I'm going to take it, and I'm grateful for you because you make this work. I was still skeptical. I was like, I don't want to do the whole thing, but you made it work, man. No. So I appreciate you, man.
For sure. I would you say, and I think you kind of did, that struggle all the way up until you actually, you found the light within you to be able to share and not be afraid to share it. Do you feel like that was the transition for you that actually, brought it?
Absolutely.
From,
absolutely. I share my dark. We all have, you have to share your dark. We keep our dark inside. Why? What is it? Yes. What is it going to do? Sharing my dark gives me my light.
I call it embrace your reality.
You have to. Whatever you've done, I don't care what you've done. I don't care. It don't matter, because if you were in the right mind, you wouldn't have done it. See, you're so hard on yourself. We get so critical of people and not realizing if they were in their right mind, none of us would be. We all got a little, because we all have done something a little different or something that we could be questioned, because we all have that moment where we step out and be like, man, okay, all right. But some of us can't be pulled back. Some of us go too far. Some of us. So why can't you judge somebody who you've done the same things, but they weren't able to pull this from the same rope. Like, that's not fair. Like, I'm very critical of that. Like, I'm I walk by, I drive by homeless people, I know I've made worse mistakes than them.
Yeah.
That's what keeps me humble.
Understanding perspective of the story before one judges.
Yeah.
I've used the idea too of it's not the what, it's the why. So, you know,
that's my ministry, man. You don't understand. You just tapped into my ministry, man. I'm launching the why ministry, man, because we don't concentrate on the why. Yep. We don't.
Nope.
Man goes crazy, kills 19 people. It's the what we focus on, but we don't focus on the why. We don't dissect the 6 months leading up to that. And we miss it. Everything we see in humanity, everything we see is a mental health crisis, but we don't look at it as that. Because if they were in a right mental mind, they wouldn't do that. But we won't look at it like that. We critical and we go overlook every single thing instead of looking at every single situation as a mental health issue. We won't. And until we get there, that's when we get the real change.
I think in addition to that, even to the fact of when we do get to that, of making sure we don't blame them for being there, it's, you know, for instance, like, your past is not your fault. Your past is part of what you had to go through. And it was a struggle that you had to get through. And that's not fair to put that on you, to judge you for that, but to understand that light that you have. And you know, as you said, be more thankful as a society and not suppress some of these, what we see as hardship, but really embrace them and celebrate them for, you know, the reality that they're in and they're facing.
It's different, you know, for me, because I understand accountability.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't understand that people have no idea what they're up against. Yeah. People don't understand how real this dark place is. People don't really understand how the world is designed and how things how it's happened. And you know, depression, suicide has touched every place in the world.
Yes.
Name something else that has. Like, that's what people, we won't tear away and really, really look at it for what it is. We won't. We go around it because we don't want to talk about it, because it scares us, because we don't understand it, because it's easier, because it doesn't affect us, knowing that it does. We're affected. Everybody's affected by depression, because everybody in the world is dealing with something. We all mask it differently. And I keep saying, everybody in the world is struggling with something. It doesn't matter how much money you have. We've seen the richest, you know, the two richest men in the world both getting divorced.
Yeah.
So I keep telling people, you know, that's just how the reality of life is. You have to realize that everybody has a great way of masking what they're dealing with. You know, Instagram is not really a reality of what people are really, really dealing with. You can be anybody you want to be, but who are you really? Who are you when you take the mask off? You know, who are you when you take the uniform off? Who are you when you're not, you know, behind closed doors, when you're by yourself? That's who you are.
The wall that people put up to hide that is usually what is the creation of conflict. When you're able to actually sit there and embrace that light, you're able to present yourself as the true you. And so there's really no, you know, it's clear. You're able to share that. And I think that's important.
I've lied too long. I've lied for so many years about who I am that people don't even know who I am. And I can't, that's hurt me, because it's like, you think that I am this way and I'm not even that way.
Yeah.
Like, there's no, it's people that would, if they really asked me questions, they would have no idea. And you'd be like, I know Kev, I know. And they don't even understand. Like, Kev has no, I don't have no, nothing in this world moves me. Like, the greatest place in the world for me is in the presence of God. Like, I've always felt that way. And part of my depression has been that once I felt that presence when I was so heavily in the church, and then when my parents divorced and I got away from the church, I got away from the presence. And my life trying to get back on case with that, that has been a roller coaster episode in itself. So it's just so many different things. Now I have to, like, when you build so many habits, when you create a certain person, that certain person has bad habits. And we try to be something that we aren't, and we start doing all these different things that are not us. And then that creates its own depression. Yep. It's like, it's so easier being accepting who you are and accepting exactly what you're going to go through and process it right then and there. When I deal with my emotions right then and there, I tell people right then, I'm going to cry right now, and I'm fine with it.
Yep.
Same. I'm not about to wait until later because I don't want to have people see me. No, man. I'm upset right now. I'm processing why I'm upset, but I'm upset right now. Please, I'm mad right. Like, I'm dealing with my emotion right when it happened, man. I'm not waiting until later and trying to, because something else is gonna happen, and then I'm gonna forget, and then something else gonna happen, and I'm gonna forget, and then you know what's gonna happen? I'm gonna carry Monday's issues into Tuesday, and Tuesday has its own issues, and then I'm still gonna get over Tuesday's issues, dealing with halfway Monday's issues, and here come Wednesday. Wednesday got a whole nother set of issues. Then I'm trying to still get over Monday. I haven't even got caught up with Tuesday. Thursday and Friday and Saturday got their own issues. Imagine doing that for 50 years of your life. And we wonder why people are the way they are. They haven't realized that their baggage is just caught up with them. Come on, let's just be real. You got to learn how to process however people made you feel. If that person up you made you upset, just deal with it. Stop making yourself believe, oh, I shouldn't be tripping. No, you tripping. So just trip and just process tripping. Like, okay, I'm tripping, but really, why am I tripping? Let me look at that and say, okay, like, a lot of stuff has to do with my root. Like, when my wife does things, I have to look at it and compare it to my root. Like, am I really tripping off her not calling, or am I really focused more on my root that I have abandonment issues? You see what I'm saying? Yeah. It's a big difference that I can focus on, oh, she missed one call, or I can focus on, Kevin, you need to really get this abandonment issues together so you don't really feel vulnerable when she doesn't call. Because that's your wife. She knows she loves you. You see what I'm saying? Yep. But we don't process that way, man. All right, man.
No, you're good. No, I love it. You've got me speechless because it's so true. These are a lot of the things that, you know, I haven't had the extreme, you know, suicidal thoughts. I have, this last year was a struggle. Nothing compared to, you know, what you've gone through.
But see, no. Look, don't minimalize you.
Yeah.
I tell people that all the time.
Yeah.
Like, because I don't know your life.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Don't. It ain't no compare. you got your own. No. Your significant...
Yep.
Pain is valuable, brother.
Yep.
I didn't mean to cut you off. I just had to tell you that. Man, I want to listen. Go ahead. I'm listening.
You're right. You know, there's so much where I could go with all these because it's so strong. I feel like we're going to need to do like 3 or 4 of these episodes because it's strong. let's keep going. You know, what a... two things. Like, one thing you kind of stirred me on is my very first podcast in reception to what we just talked about, was a friend of mine who lost her leg on a rock climbing accident. And I asked her, how does it feel to be held up as a hero? And she said exactly like you were saying, is that just because you see my leg gone doesn't mean that somebody else isn't going through something just as extreme financially, a relationship, a death in the family, and that's something that we need to look at. And, you know, that kind of leads me to a question to even ask you, you know, up until that event, that this became public, that it became, you know, an event, you know, how do you feel in that sense, you know, almost asking the same question of when people see that, they see that as a hero, but the person before that, for example, the lady at the, that you asked, she didn't see that. how do you feel in that sense? Does that make sense?
That's a good question. Yeah. Listen. This is how I live my life. I have the understanding that Kevin Berthia made a decision to go to the bridge and jump. By grace, I was saved because my decision was made. I didn't get to the bridge and get talked in the car. I jumped, brother. Like I jumped. I looked in the water, made a decision on everything on the inside of me that I'm about to die. Like not try to die. We're dying. So that was my decision. So when I look at that picture and how people look at it, it's not about being a hero. It's about you have to understand that just like in my situation, in your darkest, darkest moments, it is something beyond all of us that will show up for you. But you just got to believe it. You got to believe that your life is that worth much value. And it had to be because it's billions of people on the planet. And you took up the time to show up for me. Like, when you look at the things that you go through in your life, think about the worst things you go through in your life. And we all had a worst day of our lives. We just probably don't have a picture of it. And that's why I normalize that picture every time I go and I get on that stage and I speak. I say, okay, let's look at the picture so we can get it over with. Now, yep. I want you to close your eyes and I want you to think about the worst day of your life. And I want you to imagine somebody took a picture of it. Now we're on the same playing field.
Yeah.
Because the worst day of your life looks just like that. It ain't no different, man. We've all had the worst day of our life. Nobody has not had a worst day of their life. Like, that's just, you're lying, okay? If you're honest, you've had it. Yeah. And if you had a picture of it, how would it really look? See, yeah. You didn't get a picture of it and it wasn't front page of the article. So because my picture was front page article, I have a responsibility. That's all it is. That's what I understand. I understand now that I have a responsibility because he chose me, because that picture was taken, because it was front page on the paper, because millions of people see that photo and have seen that photo and know that bridge and know what it's iconic for. And know that picture and what's iconic for, I have a responsibility to present it as, yes, this is the dark place it took me to. Now, if it can stop somebody else from getting to that dark place, absolutely I have a responsibility. We all have a responsibility because we've all had that dark place that we went to. So your dark place can unlock somebody else's dark place. And it can unlock you from you being in your own dark place. That's all life is a cycle of going through, going through, going through, but it's never to stop. We stop and we turn around and we forget where we go from, and then we go backwards, and then we forget which way to go, and then we go left, and then we go right. We forget forward. And we think left is forward, we think right is forward, and then all these hiccups in life. You know, bad relationship here, alcoholism, gambling, whatever it is here, baby, it's on the wrong trail where you're supposed to be. Because the greatest things that happen to you in your life when you know you're doing what you're supposed to do. Like, let's just be honest. Like, if you're honest with yourself, the greatest feelings in life are when you're doing what you're supposed to do. I didn't get this feeling until I got on that stage and started really just being. I'm not a speaker, man.
Yeah.
I'm not. And that's why I had to tell myself, because I struggled in the beginning. Briggs will tell you, I was a horrible speaker. But if somebody told me, Kevin, you don't have to memorize your story, and it changed my life, because everybody tried to have me ball my story up and memorize this and say it this way. I had management in the beginning, and I just said, no, I have to. This is what I want to do. I want to be able to just talk. Let me talk the way I want to talk. You know, it's probably going to have some things that are said kind of to the left a little bit, but it's fine. It's just who I am. It flows better when you just let me be who I am. Like, this is who I am. And so that's my story, man. That's it. That's the answer, you know.
It's a beautiful story. I think one thing that I would compare kind of to that that my brain is kind of coming to is, you know, kind of the relationship between, you know, my mom when she passed, it was this really fast experience in this fight, because they didn't want to talk about death. They didn't want to talk about these things. And then with Brianna, she had cystic fibrosis. And so we constantly were talking about death. We were talking about all these things that society loves to suppress and say that is bad, when it's all these things that are normal. And it's, I'm going to say it's backwards. It's completely backwards. And the fact that, you know, everything that we feel like we can't do because society says that's not right are all the things that are actually normal. So when you talk about death, you need to talk about addiction. You need to talk about all these things. They're not bad things. They're things that everybody goes through. And we need to normalize them so we can talk about them. We need to talk about them so we can move through them. And to accept them, embrace them, allows us to actually move past those things. And that's where that why comes in, is, you know, we get mad when somebody lies to us. We get mad when something happens. Yet, as you said, the bigger discussion is the why of understanding what led up to that, to create the real change, to create something real. And so that's what I see in your message even more is you know, there's a power there. And it's very encouraging.
I'm gonna change the world, man. And I'm not just saying that, like, listen, man, you know, a lot of people say that stuff and they think, nah, man, I'm telling you, I have something in me.
Yeah.
That I know if I can ever, I gotta get it. You know, my battle every day is every day. Like, I battle every day with really dealing with the same, like, issues of waking up. I gotta battle that head, that voice that says you are worthless. You know, I gotta, Mother's Day just passed, I gotta still battle dealing with being a, I still gotta battle these things, but I'm telling myself, Kevin, if you can really just see, like, you, your message, like, it's always been like this, but I've always been this way. Like, 11 years old, you know, I was talking to a homeless man that was in a wheelchair that had no legs on a Chicago bridge. On one of our trips, family trips, we stopped in Chicago because we took the train to Disney World, and we stopped in Chicago. Like, I remember these moments. This is who I've always been. I just got so far away from it because of life. But this, I have something in me that's going to change the dynamic of how our loved ones are treated when they are dealing in the mental health world. They're dealt with wrong. Your loved ones are dealt with wrong, and that's what's keeping them in that dark place. Like, humanity treats them like they're animals, and they're not. Like, you know, that man you see walking down the street who's yelling and everybody's laughing. If you take the time to listen to, I do it all the time. My whole life, I've always wondered what they want. What are they talking about? Because it's a message. It's something. What are they saying? What's going on? Who are they talking? Like, what? You know, and we don't know their story. We don't know. This could be a Vietnam vet. Why? Because you don't see, they don't have their hat on that says they served their country. Come on, man. We miss it because we judge instead of looking at our own lives and saying, grace is the reason why we have everything we have. Like, and it's not what we do. It's not the things that we accumulate. It's not because you don't really do it. We are not in control of anything. You can wake up and it all can be gone.
Yeah.
We are not in control of anything except our response. That's it. That is the only thing that God gives us, the will. He gives us all this free will. You think you can do anything you want to do, and you can't.
Yep.
You can't. Because the truth of the matter is, something's going to happen. It's going to go this way. You're only in control. We didn't know where we was going to come. We didn't get to pick our birthday. We didn't get to pick our name. None of this. Like, not how we look, where we come from. Like, nothing. We are not in control of nothing. The sun goes up, it goes down on nobody's command.
I've got to ask you in that. One thing I can see, and I just want to ask, did you see as your story goes, kind of in the survival mode where you were very self, you know, I got to survive. I got to create this. I got to create this. And as soon as you saw the light, did you notice a change where it became this outward energy where you wanted to help others, and that outward energy actually gave you more light, more understanding, more progression, more processing of life, and give you more things to be thankful for or be able to see more?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I tell people all the time, when people inbox me and they're in these dark places, and I tell them, you're doing more for me than I could ever do for you.
Mm.
I tell people, I don't care. People, I've helped hundreds, I don't know, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter. You know, after my events, it's a line. And I know somebody in that line I've come for. I've come only for one person. Like, everybody's in line, they need a piece, but I've come only for one person. Somebody needs me. And I understand that. And I'm fine with that. That's my purpose. Like, I gotta go through hell every single day because I want to stop people from going through their own hells. Like, and that's just, you know, a lady told me at an event, and she said, I don't want you to think I'm crazy, but I think this is what, you know, this is what this is how I look at your life. You're sitting at Hell's Gate, and your job is to stop people from going in, and you're pulling people out. Like, and it just clicked one day, like days later, what she said, and I'm like, yeah, that's about right. Like, you know, that's just, I've lived in that dark place for so long. That's, I'm able to stop people from going there, and people that are in there, I'm able to pull them out. That's just, you know, call it, you know, and because I have this love for humanity already, I fit perfectly in my purpose. It's not like I have to pretend. It's just, I can't even explain it. It's just like, I can wake up and do it for free. It's just like, oh, and there's nothing that nobody can tell me that I don't feel like I have something that can help them. It just be like, I don't care what you tell me. I don't care. It's like, I just cut last night. That's exciting to me. Because I know that I have something that can help you. Like, I have something. Like, I've talked to people that have given me their suicide notes. Because I know, like, it's something about that. It's not me. Like, I make myself available. Yeah. Like, I don't make this the Kevin Berthia show. I'm available. I make myself available. Like, yeah. You know. We all need, that's why I always tell people, we all first responders. Like, it's not, you don't need accolades, you don't need training. If you see somebody struggling, make yourself available. It's not about what you say, it's about allowing yourself to just be human. Like, I get tired of people saying, I don't know what to say. It's not, sometimes support is silent. Make yourself available.
Yes.
Do you think Kevin Berthia knows what to say to people when they say to me these, when they tell me these dark things? I'm the most empathetic person in the world. I crush on the inside when I hear some of the stuff that people tell me. But you know what I'm able to do? I make myself available, and the word is given to them. Like, that's just how it works. Like, I make myself available. Like, trust making yourself available. Just try it one time. Go to a situation where you know you don't have anything to say and just make yourself available. It will change your life. But yes, we don't, you know, we want to focus on, you know, the what ifs. I've been to a lot of funerals of people that wish that they could have reached out to loved ones. Why do we wait until they're gone? Like, reach out now. Tell the people you love them now, every single day. I love you. 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 Because you're not going to have the opportunity. You know, that's just, you know, I'm preaching. Okay.
No, it's, you're right. It's so true that, you know, life is so short, and that, you know, we get caught up in the fear, and you could see that in these conversations. You can see that in people's success. They're feel scared to fail. They're scared to fail. Well, failure is part of success. Yeah. And you know, not to.
I saw something a long time ago, and it changed my life.
Yeah,
that starting over, it just means you didn't give up.
All it is, yes, yes.
Hey, that was the, like, it was life changing because I thought, yeah. Like, yeah, that's it. Because it's not. It's better than giving. If you got to start over 100, we got this thing now. We just press reset. All right. I'm having a day. Reset. Like, however many times, but it's no many time. You can do it a million times. but you're not giving up.
Yep. I think, you know, you just keep going. And I think one thing I wanted to connect back with, you know, when COVID hit, we had some support groups and the areas we talked to, and everybody kept saying, well, here's the phone number. Here's the phone number if you are hurting. And I raised my hand and I stopped and I said, well, let me return that around. If you feel comfortable where you are, can you do me a favor and start reaching out to people that you feel are not in a comfortable spot, because they need that energy and they need some help. And I think, kind of like you said, is that's part of the normalization and to help people, you know, speaking for myself anyways, when I was in a tough spot, and I get in a tough spot, it's not always the person that I'm looking for is, you know, not always the other person that's challenged. I'm looking for others too, that I can feel normalized. And I think that's one thing that we forget is that, you know, I was telling Kevin this, Kevin Briggs, you know, there was a friend of mine that called up and he said he didn't have much time, but he had listened to me for 5 minutes. And I was like, I didn't want, like, you listened. That's all I needed, is that little bit of time to be able to share. And that's, you know, the huge message, you know, that has come from a lot of that. I got to ask some questions going a little bit deeper. So on both sides, you know, there's a person who's actually going through this struggle and I'm trying to get out of it. I'm stuck in it. But then there's also the people that are see this and are trying to help. They're in fear that they're going to say something that's going to, you know, trigger it. They're going to, you know, they push away as opposed to say, you know, listen.
You ready for this?
Yeah.
Ready? I got you. And people ask me that all the time, because they always say, I'm scared of what I'm going to say.
Yep.
Every human that has breath on the face of this planet has built in compassion. Because why? Why do I know that? Because you have a heart. Like, you cannot live without it. Okay? Like, I've done a lot of research. The heart is very, very important for everything. And because you have that, you have to trust that because you have a heart, and because if you're reaching out in the first place, it's not about what you say. It's about allowing yourself to be available and trusting that you're going to say the right things because you're reaching out and you love them. Yep. Like, they just need, like, if you're reaching out to somebody that you know, then think about the things about them. Think about the things that you do know. Like, what can I say? We worry too much when the idea is they just need to know that you there for support.
Yep.
However you can support, figure it out.
Yeah.
Like, if you're there, you'll figure it out. Like, I never know what to say, but I never worry about what to say either.
Right.
Like, you can have somebody call me right now on the spot, and I'm not going to know what they're going to tell me, but I'm going to know what to say to them, because I'm making myself available, because I'm trusting my heart, because I know Kevin really cares, because I honestly do.
Yes.
So I know anything that come out my mouth going to be gold, because I honestly, from the bottom of my heart, care about every single person on the face of this planet, right, wrong, or otherwise. I don't care what you look like. I don't care what you've done. I don't care what jail you're in. I don't care what you've done to humanity or what people think about you. I care about you, because that's just who I am. And I'm not going to be in denial about who I am anymore, because somebody has to be the one that cares enough to say, no, I'm the one. I care about all humanity. Like, you know, I'm that one. Fine. And I'm tired of being sitting around waiting on somebody to validate it or tell people about it or no. I'm one. If I got to be one and only, that's fine, because that's what I was created to be. I was created to carry this torch for the next 60 years to make humanity change, so that my legacy is left with humanity different. So that I know my great grandkids wake up in a world where they can, no matter what problem they're dealing with, they can talk to whoever they are in front of.
Yep.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what anybody's dealing with. We can. Oh man, you know what? This is what I'm dealing with. And we stop and have conversations. We live in a world that doesn't live in their phones. We live in a world that lives in each other's lives. And I'm not gonna stop. That's just who I am. You know, I got to put 60 in this. I'm 38. put 60 in this, and that's what I got. I got 60 years to do this. I got 60 years to make buildings, into lighthouses that say the Kevin Berthia Foundation on them. That's just where I'm at. And I'm not going to stop.
Do you find yourself every morning when you wake up, a lot of people like to take that elephant, push it under the rug and forget about it and wake up with, I'm going to forget about it and move on. Do you find yourself rather opening up that box every morning and being like, this is me. And this is
a challenge. Yeah. I ain't going to lie. The pandemic has, I've been probably one of the biggest fights since the pandemic. Cause it took away what I finally found my niche. November of 2019, I spent all this time traveling, going to all these different places. And in Indiana, in a high school gym, I found myself. It's like, that's the click I need. It was just like, Kevin, you could change the world. Yeah. It was in a high school gym. They literally shut down the whole school and brought me the whole school. Wow. And I was talking to like 2,100 people and in a big Indian, because Indiana basketball is big. So this is a huge gym. Yep. And in that moment, afterwards, it was like 100 kids in line. And it was just so moving. We all was in tears. I mean, I knew that I had to just be who I knew I was called to be. And I just, I just got out of management. So I'm now representing myself. And then boom, I got on one event. March 10th, 2020 was my last event. And then the pandemic hit. Yeah. So then I haven't spoken on a stage since March 10th, 2020.
Yeah.
So that takes me away from that gift that of what I know I can give to the world, what I can give to humanity, because I only can do so much online. I'm not an online guy. You can put me in front of a million people and I'm comfortable talking, and it could be any walk of life, any talk of people, I'm going to backpack, before when I really get onto, what I really want to do. And I really want to take this message and learn, however many languages and backpacking to different tribes who are really, dealing with depression and really dealing with suicide, at a higher rate than we are in America, and really, send my message that way so they can get hope too. I mean, it's for the world. It's not just for this country. It's not just for a state. I'm for the people.
I think it's huge that feeling to give back. And I think, as you were saying this, I kept thinking of this hero thing. And not to say that you or I are any different than anybody, because like we've said, everybody's going through a struggle. And I think when people raise other people up, that only difference is that vulnerability of the other person being able to share their true reality and the other person trying to find a way to be able to share the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think, that's one thing I've seen, and I feel the same way as you do, is that, if we could get people to be more open, and to talk about it. Another question I wanted to ask, going a little bit deeper, what are some ways, because we've talked about some heavy stuff, right? Some ways to be able to get through that? Communication, I think, is definitely huge, and being
That's, the critical thing what people don't realize is you have to accept who you are. See, in accepting who you are, you'll find what you need for yourself. And you'll find what you need to say to people to help you and things that's going to help you grow. See, when you don't accept who you are, you'll get around situations, say the wrong thing, get around the wrong people, be in the wrong environments, get the wrong jobs, be in the wrong relationships, all the different things, because you're not accepting who you are. You're expecting people to see you for who you think you're showing, and you're not, because you haven't accepted who you are. So acceptance has to be the key to fixing any root. You got to accept, okay, this is who I am. I am this way because of the things that happened to me. And see, truth be told, we don't realize that we are who we are because of the things we've experienced. We think we just magically are the way we are. Oh, I'm just magically scared. No, you're scared because something happened to your life that made you frightened. And now that was impactful and that traumatized you. That trauma is in your brain. The movie Inside Out is the best movie humanly possible. Everybody should be, it should be a mandatory, like every human should have to watch that like 10 times. Like it explains life because we deposit these thoughts and they go and they stay with us and they that's just who we are. And we need all these different emotions. Like we need sadness, we need anger, we need all that we have to, it just can, they have to balance each other out. And I think that we all are striving for that balance. I'm a Libra. So we, go figure, a Libra that was born in Suicide Prevention Month. My life was supposed to be mental health. Like that's just, if I go, I wasn't supposed to be a basketball player. I wasn't supposed to be anything else. I was supposed to be doing this because this is where I feel the most joy. Like this is where I get my most everything out of. And this is where I can help humanity the best. So if you're not doing your most anything, you're not going to get the best out of it. But that goes into accepting who I am. Like I had to go have 22 failed suicide attempts. I had to try. I guess I had to try every single different way. So now that when I talk to people, I can relate to them. I don't know. Like it wasn't for me. Like, if I stayed in this stuff, I sit here and be like, man, think about all the different things. I get overwhelmed with it. But if I just think about, oh, well, I was sitting in Wyoming of all places and I was able to connect with somebody because she had a suicide attempt that was similar to mine. Like, who would have thought I would be in all places, that's how life works. So, I got to catch a plane, man. I'm sorry. I looked at the time. I was like,
oh, no.
Let's do whenever you want to do this again.
Yep.
Just count me in.
Okay.
You got me, man.
Yep. Can I ask one more question?
Yep.
Yep. So choose your attitude, create your life is the quote that Brianna created. And I ask everybody at the end of the podcast what that means to them and how they would interpret that. I'd love to hear on your side kind of how you would bring that to light.
I mean, you have a choice, you do have a choice to I feel like your attitude is your response. And that's the only thing you are in control of. So when you say choose your attitude, you have the choice to choose how you're going to deal with how you feel. We it's not our fault. A lot of our situations aren't our fault, but we have the choice to how we respond to them. And the things that are our fault is our choice to how we respond to us. We have to know that, we have to learn how to forgive ourselves. We got to learn how to move things. That's a choice. And that attitude really, like they say, your attitude, determines your aptitude. And like that's, they learn that all younger in life, but it does. How you go depends on your choice of attitude. So that's the way I would look at it.
That's beautiful. Kevin, thank you so much. It's been an honor. We definitely need to extend this because it's already an hour and a half we've talked, but there's so much more I wanted to ask, but thank you for doing what you do. You're a true inspiration, even to me. So I appreciate you, and we'll talk soon.
All right, man. Have a good one, man.
All right, you too. Thank you so much. And that's this episode of the Choose Your Attitude podcast. It is a pleasure to be able to have Kevin Berthia on this show. It is so amazing what he has in his story. It's so inspiring. As you can see, we just continued to talk and barely were even able to get into it. His story is so inspiring and so thankful for him to be on. If you want to get to know more about him, you can go to kevinberthiafoundation.org or you can see him on Instagram at _grateful on Instagram. As always, we love to have you guys. Again, because we talked about some heavy topic, if you or somebody you know needs some help, please, please go find help. That number for this National Suicide Prevention Hotline, they can provide some help and assistance. Their number is 1-800-273-8255. Again, that's 1-800-273-8255. 8255. There is a website called suicidepreventionlifeline.org. It's the same group. There is chat available there. So if you need to be able to talk in that form, they have that as well. As always, we are just so thankful for our listeners, Thank you for listening. It has been an amazing episode. We're going to have some more coming up. So thanks for listening. See you for now.
Thank you for listening. To reach out to Nick and the Choose Your Attitude community, find us on social media at Choose Attitude Create Life. Share your attitude with the world with merch guaranteed to encourage at ChooseYourAttitude.com. Be sure to share us with friends, family, and colleagues. And while you're at it, leave us an uplifting review. We'd very much appreciate it. Check back for new episodes. Until next time, choose your attitude, create your life.